This is the governor's fraud in the second day. This is the governor's fraud in the second day. This is Channel 1 Riot on Emerson Reel 9. Emerson Reel 9, Channel 1 Riot. The governor's fraud in the second day, Monday of the 10th week. Going over slowly the full lecture it turned out to be on Friday.
Too much territory. I wanted to, I just seemingly had to do that. Now, I'd like for to check into it. And in some places I told you I wasn't sure of my ground. And in other places, I moved so fast, you wouldn't see too clearly where I was going. Material that I gave you. We talked about the using a body of salt. Carol, I've had to work on in that is what I gave you, Eric Fromm. And after I heard that, that was on my mind. And over a period of several weeks, you know, I kept working on it, and I got this manuscript, and it seemed like a perfect manuscript, and it went along with this little piece from Mark Twain that I've been reading. Now, what I want to do is work that out with you. Fromm's proposition is that education, he's talking about the universities, is basically abstract and unsound. The problem is to convert the abstractions into what he calls experience. The paper I read to you, I just gave you a little, two paragraphs of it, but that ought to make it clear. And this girl is a good writer and a good student. I commented on it as I went along, showing you that she never can get hold of her abstraction, that the frontier produced what's typically American. Did it? Very difficult for her to state it. And then she can't state it in a form in which she can use it. Or she never does. But her instinct is right. She tries to. And then she tries to picture the American frontier with the influence of the frontier. What I've noticed is that we live with the abstract to the point, to the extent that we feel more at home with it than we do with the concrete or with experience. And you can shift it just a little bit more and say, we're willing to barter away experience for another degree. I'm just pursuing it, so on. Now, I'll tell you what, you're getting outside the tape. I'd stay within the material I gave you. I've worked with that, and I can handle that. He's talking about the frontier theory. And then he's trying to show the American as he's influenced with the frontier. You might say experience is mental. Experience what you do. Except experience has to be mental, too, when you look at it. When you look at it. It's raw experience. If you don't, it's just a daily occupations. You see, I pursue this. Keep this in mind. And in the writing, all I get is abstract. That's all I get on the papers. It's turned in abstraction, and almost all I get. And I remember in a writing class one time, I said to talk about some people, put some people in. And in this age in which he said, we love people, no people got into it. I think that's true. I mean, that's my experience. I've worked with it. So that Ishmael, Melville, you see, presents the knights and squires. And they look simple enough, but we can't do that. Mark Twain shows Huck and those people along the river, Pap, Finn, the others, But we can't do that. We can't put people in. Not if we've been to school. Now, I'm just bringing up the point now, you see. that's implicit. That's implicit in the statement. Now, you see, all these people we've talked about have declared against abstractions. You see, Emerson is the heart of it. Now he won't even rearrange his thoughts to the point that they're logical and consistent and easily understood. He's going to take his thoughts as fresh as he can as they come to him and set them down and not tamper with them. Anyone has to. And you see the extreme to which Whitman goes. Well, now look how the world changes. In Yeats and in T.S. Eliot, you see, you've got such an abstract world that it's, as I said, it takes a PhD to penetrate it. They teach in high school, I don't know why, quite. Oh, that's a learned world, that T.S. world of T.S. Eliot. You may think you're getting into it. I thought one time I was getting into the world of E.M. Forster. I was a GI in India. A lot of the time we just had nothing to do but read third class mail, if we could get it. And I ran across that book of him, Passage to India. I thought, this is fine. Now I'll find out something about India. I hadn't elected to go there. I had never even dreamed of going there, you know. It wasn't in my plans at all. But there I was. Might as well make the most of it. So I read it. Well, sir, now I know something about India. Well, sir, a few years after that, a boy, man, joined the staff I was on, who had just was just writing a dissertation on who did I say? E.M. Forster. And Passage to India. And I found out that I had never got into E.M. Forster. He's in that abstract world of T.S. Eliot to such extent. Never know. Now, you see, this world of Henry James is not too easy to enter. I can sort of help you get into one corner of it, but see, I haven't taken you very far. Now, E.M. Forster says in the little freshman piece in there I was looking at this morning, he said that art, of all the objects in our world, is the only object that has internal structure. That doesn't mean that art's the only thing of importance. All right, you see, that's fine. Art is the only thing that has internal structure. You think you've got some, but you take that home with you and look at it and talk with your family about it, and you find out that you haven't the faintest idea, but you took home your little sack. Furthermore, these abstractions, I didn't mean to get off on this. How in the world we do this? God is dead, you see. That has absolutely no meaning and shouldn't be used. Nietzsche used it in an offhand way. Now my neighbors use it as condemning the age, especially the young people. And they say God is not dead. Well, he's dead in a good many ways, even to them, if they knew it. They don't think of him as a creator. Not anymore. They might not admit it, but they don't think of him in those terms. So to that extent, the old God is dead. Well, I don't mean to set my neighbors straight. I'm just pursuing this little idea, is all. That is, the way she represents the modern us, call it Freudian, a new psychology, you still got a body of thought that you've got to somehow work with. Well, when you go home, you won't talk at all, you see. You think everything be wrong. I think it is. Won't say any of these things. I think the term, what I proposed to you was, that the term, a common word, is better. Now, you see in your little papers, you use nature against all my pleas. I use fresh terminology. Make it just as usable as you can. Don't lean on things. The preacher says, Jesus will help you. And he puts his heart into it. But in his as he's using it, that's just a mere cliche. It's just like saying, I love nature. See, you're involved. You can't keep involved. Now, that's the heart of Whitman and Emerson's world, is the concrete. And Whitman says the abstract shouldn't be there. That any little abstraction will carry a long way through objects, through experience, you know. I talk, every time I get talking, I talk like I wrote the book, Two Strands of the Governess. there is that old governess, the governess, you see, that Hester. And furthermore, you see, James keeps that in your mind through that older governess. You see, she has survived this experience and is looking at it and examining it. Now, in that sense, you see, she's not, that's not the new psychology. You see, that's Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman. Ishmael is the one who lived with the experience to the great extent of anyone I've ever seen. He doesn't exclude anything. I mean, he seems to live with it. Now, in the screw, he starts off with the new psychology. If you don't mind, I'll just use for general term. It's easy to use that Freudian thesis. That first summer was what was it? Was a series of flights and drops. Yes. Now that's Freudian. That's it. Yeah. Now that's not the young governess, but that's the old governess, you see, as she looks back at the experience. She starts out with her interpretation of it. Now we don't recognize that as a thesis because he doesn't use technical language. He avoids it, you see. If he'd said this is you see in this a lot of psychosomatic symptoms, that'd get our attention. In our time, we have to use jargon in order to make the point clear. Yeah.
I got a question.
Don't make a question. Talk a little bit.
If the governess is looking at...
I think so. I think that's one function the second governess, older governess, saw.
She saw the...
Yes. Yes. Now, it's the same thing as I said to you. Her diagnosis of her early experience... is our solution. Once we know what's happening to us, we know what to do. And the remedy is extraordinarily simple. It's just get out from under some of the responsibility. Just lighten up the load. So you're not so tense, you know. I see how simple it is for somebody to say it like me who doesn't know anything about it. Now, see if you got some of the experts. They wouldn't hardly be able to explain it, could they?
I've never followed that through, and I don't know to what extent that play is there of the old governess and the young governess. As far as I've looked at it, I can see it. And I see that's one of the things I never get. I'm always half-baked, you see. Everything I say to you needs a little more thought. Just never get that far. Now, that's what I'd like for you to do in your papers, to pick up where we leave off here. That'd be a nice point to pursue. I tell you, I thought anxiety would take care of everything, at least through the end of Flora. Ms. Van Arnhem said it's not right. That's not right. I look for the extreme cases later with that experience at Miles where the real turn of the screw takes place. A crate of bananas, and you got to put up banana bread, you see, over the weekend. You haven't got much choice. You got to do that. I fall short is I haven't located, I haven't isolated, and I can't handle with you those extreme cases of disorders in the governments. I can't handle them. But I'm sure they're there. Now, I don't think James would put them in to the extent Poe would, because he knows that they will destroy his story. But they'll be at least visible. At least you can identify them as being there. But then James has stacked the cards so she can't win. Everything's against her, including the infatuation for the master. That's also burdensome on her. Makes her nervous. You've got an innocent point there. I don't think so, though. I think it starts at the time they start diagnosing it. I don't think it started in Emerson's time, Whitman's. That belongs to, we invented that. We do it ourselves. That's our contribution to the world. From about, about the time of the turn of the screw. See, Conrad put it into his story. It's there. Started right strong. I think we're out of our depth right now, but I don't think that's great. I think you have witnessed the birth of the modern world. You see it, a borning. Not just in terminology, not just being recognized, but coming to life. That's it. Still, most of the people I know don't live in this world. Their children may, but they don't. They do not live in this world. As one of my neighbors said not long ago, he said, people are just nothing like they was when I was growing up. And I don't think they are. You see, you've got the two remedies. The older governess diagnoses it. And then you have a knowledge of Heston Ishmael. So that you know where health lies, you see, within your experience. Leonard Whirl, everybody got to be Leonard. One of the young ministers came up in there, and he had to be Leonard too. And they flocked around there, and they were learning, reading all these Leonard works. And one of the girls, you see, who took it right seriously, went batty, went off a rocker, clear off. Nothing except reading the new theology. It's incomprehensible. The people who write it don't have any much idea much what they're saying. Their terminology is incomprehensible. I've got some specimens over there in my files. Well, they couldn't pass freshman course. Oh, their jargon is thick. Now, I'm not talking about any one. You see, the sociologists outdo everybody. It's a hard world. See, it's a hard world to navigate in. What Margaret Mead says, you see, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just drawing some of this material together. You see, I think that is one of the things. It's very simple. Very simple, you see. I read you that. What does she call it? House. The two people have all the responsibility to meet all this modern world. You see, the intensity with which the American woman with children tends to her task of homemaking includes innumerable excursions out of the home as consumer, as transportation officer of the family, as responsible citizen who must protect the environment in which the children are. That's a family. Every family and home is home. I remember, this is in the freshman reader, I remember one of society's traps. Oh, it gets you. It gets you, don't you know? You can see very well. I see what happens to me and all like that. You see, it's institutions. Now, you know, you're really rich. Sure. What we used to figure in a little country college that I worked in was that after a man got to the point where he could read a book and kind of had half a notion what was in it, he ought to be left alone and read around any way he wanted to, but not have any more courses. Try to institutionalize that. Oh, man alive, you see. The pressures with this family, this world, this family life, such as we have it, every family home is own, such. That's for one thing. Then your jobs and all like that. You see, there's no such thing as a mental life. Decided is not possible. Not a mental life. Now, you say that little island, you can go to the research library and get a little cubicle. That helps, if you can get over there. Don't you know, in the 20s, Henry from the American presses. It's an awful country, you know. Awful, awful, awful. You see, inhumane, violent, rush, hardly anything good you can say about it. Yeah?
You say that the
home family? Emersonian in illumination. That somewhere along the line it has to come to a man, you see, that he's caught. Now, I don't know the answers. I'm just carrying it just this far, you know. Actually, you see, as far as I'm carrying it, it's in this little article here. What she says, you see, about the thing. Got to yourself, you see, just one. I have this definite suggestion about your papers. Now, you see, you can pick up a good bit from this little experience. You're reporting. Well, you see, I think Thoreau could give it a little coherence. And that's why I suggested you bring it through. And there's several things, just a second. And there's several things about Thoreau. Now, you see, Thoreau, he knows enough, he has watched enough, that he can do this little thing on the loon. Or the red squirrel. Well, I'd like to see you do something like that. I mean, I didn't mean it quite like that. I mean, that's a possibility. And you can sort of follow his example. Now, look, implicit in that is a larger attitude, you see, towards the world. He's not scientific.
when he gets scientific, it's not interesting. What he writes in his journal is not interesting reading. Not like the loon. One of the nice things about Thoreau is that reverie. That's a 19th century thing. Don't you know where he sits in the boat and feels that hook way down there, and all sorts of thoughts occur to him? Say trance, I don't know what you call it. I'm not good at defining it. But it's a reverie. It's a remarkable thing. Daydreaming, I don't know what it is. Now, you say you sit out and look over the countryside. Well, that seems sort of dull to me. Unless, you see, you know what you're doing. Unless you have a little reverie. Unless you allow something to get your attention which will make your mind focus. But now, whether your car breaks down or not, I think is irrelevant. I would start right at the heart of the matter. Thoreau had this reverie, so die. Out at Miss Van Arnold's, anywhere you want to put it, you see, to localize it. But pare away as much of the other stuff as you can. I'm just trying to, you know, follow something that Thoreau. I don't mean to imitate him, but, you know, just sort of use him. And this also gives you a little way. Now, he's interested in the economy. You could come out in the countryside and observe the economy by which people, you know, preserve themselves, live, make a living. That'd be fine. That'd be fine. He's got his neighbors there, his brute neighbors, and also his former inhabitants. Well, you don't care about the former inhabitants. Look at the ones who are out there now. You could look around at some of my neighbors or somebody like that, some of your old neighbors. It's all right. That's still Thoreau. It's all in Walden. Now, he's got his learned friends, his educated friends who come out there. I wouldn't care about that so much. I'd be glad they come, but... Now, that'll channel your reporting. Your reporting. You see, your ordinary conversation never gets to anything. It's just burdensome. Oh, it is so burdensome. You've simply got to cut away all that extraneous stuff and report a little bit. You can do that from the throw. It's nice, you can teach your children to do it. Or else you can teach them the other way. You know, at one session, I could give you the framework of this whole course so that you could write a term paper on it. And some of your papers sound as if that's what's happened. Franklin acts like Poor Richard. And Thoreau economy is an important thing. But he turns it into simplicity. Emerson preaches nature, but Thoreau understands it. You see? And you can take those little ideas, and with the genius of students now, you can just spin those around, just like cobwebs. Just spin them, spin them, spin them, spin them. There's a genius that's generated by the universities, any educational institution now, of spinning things out. Just spinning, which is duplicity, dishonesty. It faces no facts. Now that's getting excited, isn't it? I didn't do that because I didn't have to take exams the way you all do. I don't know what I'd do if I had to do that. I don't mean can't do it by myself. When you go to the examination, you ought to know what to expect. And it's not so much that I'll tell you, but I'll work it out with you ahead of time. See you next time.
I see.
Well, that's the end of that session, Monday of the 10th week, the last week, going over what I covered in the large lecture on Friday. Well, it turned out to be good-natured, but I never say just what I want to say. Roberta Soult, she stumps you. She said, now, what is the difference between abstract and concrete? takes a genius to make a statement like that. When I said it didn't matter how you got there, whether your car broke down or not, old Bill Miller flinched. He put that into his paper. Well, there were questions all along. I always mad at myself that I don't repeat the question. I just go ahead and talk about it, or, you know, pick up the discussion after they get through, and you can't tell what's there. So this is Channel 1 Right around 3:55. The discussion on Monday of the 10th week. What I covered in that large hour on Friday of the 9th week. That was Monday, the 2nd of June, 69. Monday, the 2nd of June, 69. This is Wednesday, the 4th of June, 69. Wednesday, the 4th of June, 69. This is Wednesday of the 10th week, the next to last day before exams. I worked on the examination with him today, and I did most of the talking, and we really talked. This is Channel 1 Right, around 365, Channel 1 Right, of the new reel, Emerson 9. And then this is the preparing for the examination, questions and types of questions on the examination. On Wednesday, the 4th of June, 69, this is Wednesday, the 10th.
I'd like you to suggest questions.
But I don't think you can. I think you've got your mind so full of so many things. You can't really, and I'll tell you what I'll have to do the work for you again. Now, what I'd like to do, what I have done heretofore, has been different from what I'll try to do this time. This time, I have to make an examination for people who don't come to class. In part, I've always assumed that the members of the class have come to class and they have passed the little reading test. I can use some of the old material. One thing, the examination can be useful to you. This idea of experience. Now you see, that is the basis of all of it, of Emerson and Whitman. And then you see their attitude towards experience is overturned in the New Age and the Governess. Now, tell you how that would work out, I think. To regard, now you've got the theory of it always, and then you've got the examples. Now, let me tell you, nothing I ask you to do would be difficult. And I don't want you to split hairs. And I don't want you necessarily to agree with me. I want you to use the same terminology, though, and, you know, go in the same direction. That worked out in class very nicely. See what I did with you, and the reason I could do it was because you picked me up on it and was interested in it. I don't have that. No one has Ishmael in class. You got any shifts? You see, it's already working that way. Why I go to see? Your mind shifts. The passenger. I never go to the passenger. You see, go quarrelsome. You don't sleep at night. Now that's what you see. Whitman says. Where does he say that? In the Song of Open Road. Oh, he says it so many times, with indoor complaints and libraries and all of that. So you see, both of them are actually not going to see. They're approaching the world. Is that take a little passage and get into it and look at it as something that's real and not just on in the book. I go as old Salt, the Commodore Cook. I abandon the glory and distinction of such offices to those who would like them. For my part, I abominate all honorable, respectable toils. Now, see, I'm not looking at this as symbolic. I'm trying to get away from it as symbolic. That's the last thing I would ever want to do before T.S. Eliot. It's not representational. Symbols and all like that. It's not intellectualized. They avoid that, you see. They know that, but they're avoiding it. They abominate all honorable, respectable toils, trials, and tribulations of every kind whatsoever. It is quite as much as I can do to take care of myself without taking care of ships, bark schooners, and all like that. Don't you know him?
Now, this is the sort of thing I grew up in. I say I did. I think I did. But I really don't know. But intellectually, this is one of the first things that I was ever conscious of. And this is a world in which Hemingway lived, that you might call the proletarian world. And the view of the proletarian world was that society was respectable and therefore didn't exist. It would play out of society, you see, out of respectability. Now that's the proletarian world. Thank you. Where is it? In Not Specimen Days is another one. What else do you read? Preface, 1855. You see along there where he says the poet has to live, just like the American scholar. But he puts it, he goes so much farther, you see, than Emerson did. And he says he must flood himself with immediate age. Now, you see, I think a lot of people flood themselves or glut themselves with immediate age. You can see what he means by that, reading it in context with Specimen Days. You see where he sees the world in terms of the old Italian opera and those arias. And then in his poems, he sings those arias, if that's pronounced right. And he gets those Shakespearean speeches, you see, in his mind. So you don't know when he's echoing finished. But let me tell you, I think of experience as something that's examined and not remembered. It's just part of a person. You don't remember your name, you know. Just something that's remembered, something that's you. Now, you see, now, I can't. Emily has what she calls, Charles Anderson. Now, you see, I can't read Emily straight. I have to read her through Charles Anderson. She's too, I can't read poetry anyhow, but she's too concise for me. You see, I like rough writing. I like it full and informative. As clear as you can make it, but rough. That's my style, you see. I don't want to push that off on anyone. With as little art as you can get by with. But Emily has this poem, yes. I can't keep hold of that. I must give it away or something. I hate to be so just talk from one text all the time. But I have such respect for that, especially in terms of the governess. You see, also if governess could just read this. The secret of Franklin's amazing capacity for assimilating experience. You know, that's the passage we're talking about. He is never completely absorbed, you see. He has powers in reserve. He's not wholly committed. He remains aloof, a spectator still. Even though he's busy all the time, always occupied. And an exception to that was science. Now that's that leisure. Is that leisure? Well, that's what powers in reserve. Well, now don't let me skip too many cogs here. But Anderson says what Emily Dickinson's talking about is this great leisure of a great leisure of nature, of the outdoor world. The grass so little has to do, a sphere of simple green with only butterflies to brood and bees to entertain, and stir all day to pretty tunes. The breezes fetch along. The grass stirs all day to the pretty tunes that the breezes bring, you see.
and hold the sunshine in its lap and bow to everything and thread the dews all night like pearls and make itself so fine a duchess were too common for such a noticing. And even when it dies, to pass in odors so divine, like lowly spices laying to sleep, or spikenards perishing, and then in sovereign bonds to dwell and dream the days away. The grass so little has to do. I wish I was a hay. See, she won't be regular. See, she's just the very reverse of Poe. Poe wanted to be this much. Well, you see, that comes up. This business, you see, you want to sit out and get away from things and just look around. Now, I don't know that I ever particularly want to be a vegetable. I think that state is this same leisure that Franklin's talking about. I could be wrong about all this. Now, you test it. And that Emily Dickinson's talking about. But you see, and you've got the same thing in Thoreau now. Don't you know that first summer I didn't have time to read books? Then he talks about the great margin. I don't have my book here. He likes a margin to his life. And then he holds that fishing pole and he's in touch with another world. No, I think there's always something cosmic about that leisure. I'm just talking with her. I got that idea from your papers because I think these people have gone farther than that, and you, some of you, were proposing to go. Of course, I know sometimes, you know, you feel like that when you actually just want to go to bed and sleep for a day or two. This has to be mental, you see, as well as the other. You say you don't get it in Poe.
I don't see it. I wanted to tell.
Yes. Well, now, I worked out a little of it with you. You see, that thing that looks like a nightmare is, he's thinking of it actually in terms of experience in the, what was that one? That's the Penny Pendulum? Yes. And the early part of it. However, I think you have the same problem in Hawthorne. There, in Hawthorne, it's possible that the person would read it as fiction. Like the minister after the meeting in the forest with Hester and his experience then in the town where he wants to be rebellious, you know. I think that's just read his story, not his experience. Now, don't let me get away with these things. I hadn't thought about that, but I think constantly in fiction, I think that's the reason I don't care for fiction. Don't read much of it, is the tendency to read through it and speed read it and not ever approach it as experience. Or just by willpower, see what part of this will can I reduce to experience? Yes. I think the salvation of Usher would be to read him as experience. What passages can be, you know, converted into experience. Now let me tell you. Don't you ever let any of this, your word, I never use that word, confuse you. Don't let it make you nervous, better word. You just take what you can. See, most of it I give to you is half-baked. I don't understand it either. I'm trying to follow that categories. Now, let me tell you what. The interpretation stand up. Another part that does, that brings the Emersonian world in collision with the world we live in. The governess has her one foot, you see, her feet in the Emersonian world, but she's swamped by the other one, unless, of course, you look at the older governess who has recovered. Now, this thing here, the public functions of the scholar, you have that stated very beautifully in Emerson. You probably will see it stated in the others too. I haven't carried it that far. They may say about the same thing. But now you see, public function scholar. That is not supposed to be social service. That's not feeding the poor or clothing the deprived. No, that's a different thing. That's hardly, I think what they're interested in you don't have to follow me on this. I don't think that's it. I think it's still that Emersonian point, you see, that he makes on books. What are books for, in his sense?
Books
are supposed to inspire you to your own ideas, not just take ideas from books and extract them as your own, but
you're
supposed to inspire you to think on your own. Think is a tricky word. It's but not to transmit knowledge, not in the Emersonian sense. Let me tell you what to do. Let me do this with you. Your categories. Now you see, you could stay at home and write a paper on Emerson, and pick out these points you see and find points in other writers. But I don't think it could be that you're not actually getting Emerson. The categories in which he thinks, I think, is what you're interested in. Let me just race through those with you, and you just set them down a little bit point by point as we go along. Now, you see, Emerson, as the book says, all of his life is devoted to this one point. He starts on in the self-reliance. That's the heart of Emerson. Don't you see, as in the Divinity School address, he only applies it to the ministers. And you have the basic principle there that in Emerson's view, the minister, unless he is going to live in Revelation 2,000 years ago, has to be the scholar. That's the Emersonian thought. The first thought, you see, what he does, he calls the various things. He assumes this quality of the individual that he calls genius. And you see, you can use that term, it doesn't hurt. He uses many, many terms. Now, the what is important now is the first thoughts, the intuitions. And this, you see, leads to that state of mind that he calls must inquire if it be goodness. And the mind is in this state of inquiry, not of proof, you see, not of assertion, but of inquiry. Now, the inquiry, you see, goes through that same process of first thoughts, intuitions, as you call perceptions, illuminations. Now, here's one of the most difficult things, I think, in Emerson. You see, he opposes the individual to society in order to make himself clear. I think that's his great lack of clarity. He talks about conformity, you see. He robs the individual of his
himself. And he puts himself in the position of advocating nonconformity. And from his own life, you can see that it is not an outward nonconformity. You see, it has to be a perception. That is, he sees in society and institutions those traps that the governor's found. Now, you see, he makes various statements about conformity. He talks about consistency. And you see, if you get up fresh every day, you don't try to remember what you thought yesterday. You just look at the world fresh. Then he uses science that was a little simpler in his time, and the part of science that gained universal admiration then was the ability to list all the animals in their species and say what they were kin to. That's that Linnaeus thing, you see, the classification. And that's carried on in our thought, you see. We look at a bird, we don't look at the bird, we say that is a kind of bird. And then we stop at that. So that actually we have no thought. Classification robs us of thought. And the bird hardly exists. It's so easy to read through that. Now, you apply those things. You see, these are assumptions that work out. In art defeats the first thoughts. They have to be handled so much that they're not recognizable. They're not first thoughts. They're not even thoughts anymore. They're just something else. Art, or any sort of organization, you see. Or, you see, that always that first thought, the second thoughts, second thoughts consist, in his terminology, of twisting or polishing or shifting first thoughts so that they'll be acceptable to someone else. Either acceptable or clear to someone else. But even so, you see, you're robbed of the quality of the first thoughts. Now, you see, that the assumption is, you see, that of the world is like Eden, and evil is not uppermost. Now, you see, that sort of world can't last forever. You see, Whitman split on that. He wrote the Preface 1855, where evil didn't exist. And then beginning of Grant's administration, after the Civil War, things got to such a pass, you see, that he denied any good in the whole institutions of this country. And that was in, what was that, Democratic Vistages. Now, you ought to read a few pages in Democratic Vistages just to see him blast away. Now, he returns to his other viewers, but it's not a pretty world, really. Now, here's a little side issue. In the Emersonian sense, you see, you don't have opinions. You see, you work it out in terms of position. Opinions don't work. It's the governess, Hester, as we saw first. Now Hester gains. Now she starts out with it. She starts out with it.
she gains in dignity, indignity. And Hawthorne uses the term. They look at it as if learning is also a part of the scholar, the Emersonian individual. And you see, the inquiry makes the senses alert. And at the same time, there is what I just read from Emily Dickinson, this great leisure. Or it is possible. Now, Emily Dickinson didn't say she had that. She said the grass had that. She saw that in the world outside. Now, I'll tell you what, I wouldn't be, you get to talking like this, and what I'm trying to do is put it out in little statements. And you get so many statements, it's confusing. You just take what statements you see will be useful to you. Shoot.
Yes.
The science classifies. That's scientific measure. That's it.
Did you say that it's
good for science to
classify?
Good for science, too. That's right. Yeah. The classification robs of the thought. Once you say what the bird is, then you salt it down and it doesn't exist any longer. So we sort of catch our breath and see where we stand. Now, I don't want you to feel that any of this is overbalanced. This is just a part of it. You see, in Franklin you have one sort of world, and the governess you have another, and then most of the writers we've read are in this sort of what you might call, what I've been calling, this Emersonian world. But you call it by many terms, you see. Yes, and the artist, yes, the scholar is artist. Yes, is artist. Now you see, that's right, and that's also complicated with history, the conditions in which the artist had to live, and they're all pinched. You see, Hawthorne couldn't pay his debts, and Poe just didn't have enough to eat, and there's no copyright laws. It'll be presented that way to some extent. And you see, one reason Whitman talked about subsistence living, or just living, a very simple living, you know, with a roof over his head and clapboard house, was that that's all he ever had. And that little book that can be, Allen has so much information on him, that little one volume book on Whitman. When they visited him, he just like Eric Hoffer, he lived way upstairs in a little bitty old place there, and he made tea out of an old pot. Didn't even have a place to drink out of. And sat there without any fire. Whitman did. I don't remember the details. You read it. I'm overstating it, but it was. It was pretty much that way. So now you see, this comes back to Franklin in what he talks about prudence, you see, or Thoreau adapts it. That comes back to economy. That is a system of economy in which we live. He calls it simplicity. Now, you see, we are simply always faced about that, with that. Just how simple, you see, if you want to live, can we live, is possible to live. See, you don't have to be a philosopher, or you don't have to be brilliant to talk about these things that we're talking about. I sometimes feel like when I lay them out to you like this, I'm requiring a great deal of your mental acumen. I don't think it takes any acumen to see any of these things. He's talking about a world of experience, not of the intellect. I'm about to get started again. Help me out, everybody. Let's get back. Yes, that's right. You carry some thought through your experience. Yes. You think experience is mental? I think so. Well, why don't you say that? I think so. I think experience has to be mental. If it's examined, it's mental. But now I see we're getting into complicated. We're getting into complicated, aren't we? I feel like T.S. Eliot when I talk like that. And I'm certainly not, you know. Yes. Yes. Emerson has nothing but abstractions that I have ever read. In Emerson's? Yes, I don't know. You decide that. That's a good point. Yes. Now you see what happens if you institutionalize all this. You'd have to work it out. Wouldn't that be awful? And you'd have a credo and all that sort of thing.
Doesn't Emerson?
You know, his abstractions don't hold water. None of them are right. None of them are right. Actually, his abstractions are statements, a statement that he's going to investigate. And it never works out. Whoso would be a man must be an
unconformist. Yeah, but I'm thinking of the divinity school address, and he's telling the preachers to go out instead of, you know, relying on this traditional.
Wow. He said it's 2,000 years old.
Right. And he says they're not reaching the people, so what he wanted to do was
have their own revelation.
Right.
But you'd have to call it perceptions in the Emersonian sense.
Right. He abstracted what he wanted everybody else to do.
I suppose if you had it in church, it'd be a revelation. If you had it outside, it'd be a... Our institution has its own jargon. The same thing is called something else. You know? See, Freud will call it something else. He won't call it this. I don't know what he called it, but I know he'd call it something else. Don't tell me. On your papers, actually, what I look for, I'm not too, really, you see, like I said to you, in 15, 20 minutes, or half an hour, I could say to you, the whole organization, turn it off just a minute, and then we can turn it on again. Tell you in 30 minutes enough of the abstractions of the course so that you can answer almost any question I gave you. That's a genius that's been developed these days in the academic world. So you see, it's not the thoughts, abstractions that you put in the paper that I'm interested in. What I would like to do. Now you see, you don't want to do just what I want you to do, but you want to consider it and sort of lean in that direction. I would take Ishmael's statement on why he goes to sea and just go through that. You know, what I'm asking you to do is to sort of inquire in an Emersonian way and let things come to you. Perceptions. Now, those things can come to you as you read that from Emerson himself. Something you see from Whitman.